Yay. Summer Canson, it's September. February, anyway. September 5th, right, 2012. And I want to talk about something that's been personally actually quite meaningful and important and powerful for me in the last near term, several weeks. And the topic title is Drop the Shoulds. And I want to explain to you what I mean by that. So as you may know, the Buddha taught that attachment, clinging, craving, fixity, if you will, is a fundamental source, perhaps the fundamental source of suffering. And there are four objects, classically, of what's called attachment, this clinging. What is it that we crave? The first type of thing that we crave, he put under the heading of sense pleasures. In other words, the continuance, increase, or creation of what's pleasant, the prevention, decrease, or elimination of what's unpleasant, and the transformation of what's neutral into pleasant fast. All right? That's the sense pleasures thing we tend to be attached to. So if we want to be systematically free of the costs and consequences of craving, we can look at different categories in our life, and this is one of the four big categories, attachment to sense pleasures. Second big category is what he called rites and rituals in his critique of the Brahmanism and Jainism of his time, which focused on doing rituals as the path to salvation. His focus, the Buddha's focus, was not on practices, doingnesses themselves, but rather on mental acts, in particular acts of intention. That was the path to liberation and freedom. And so he critiqued people getting attached to rites and rituals as the path that would take them home. A modern update, particularly in our sort of post-ritualistic age, is to look at routines or patterns or attachment to things being a certain way. That's a kind of modern version of rites and rituals. Those are our own rites and rituals. It's not that we shouldn't perform sacred acts or even ritualistic acts, but it has to do with a clarity about them. Are we attached to them as a kind of magic talisman that's going to do it for us in itself? That's what he spoke against. The third great category of attachment, as we're kind of reflecting on our own personal checklist of what gets us in trouble or not, is to self, the sense of me, myself, and I. Not attachment to, if you will, the personness of a unique individual that has a particular body, mind, a particular history, particular moral duties, and also moral rights. That's okay. If we're to treat all beings well, or attempt to, one of those beings has our own name tag. So there's nothing against treating that one well. It's getting caught up in self-referential processing, referring it back to me, the story of me, my possessiveness, my precious, as it were, you know, my identification, my position. That's when we get into trouble. And I think we've all seen that when an event happens and it just is an event. It's unpleasant, maybe. The brick lands in our foot. Someone steps on us in the elevator. It's an unpleasant event. But we are very aware of, aren't we, of what it's like when we tip over into taking it personally. That's when we really get into trouble. Okay. That's the third category of attachment. The fourth category is attachment to view, being rigid about, or righteous about, or high and mighty, or positional about a particular opinion or viewpoint. And this is a very tricky one that I want to speak to tonight, because the shoulds, the musts, the gottas, the insistences in the mind are a category of views that, when we get attached to, create suffering and harm for ourselves and others. I want to distinguish between principles and what I'm going to call musts or shoulds. or demands. Principles absolutely have a place. Certainly in Buddhism, and I think more broadly than that, there's a place for having values at all levels of the architecture of any living entity. Are goals of various kinds. In the mind of those entities that have information processing systems, which even the simplest might, certainly complex ones with a nervous system, including really complex nervous systems like the one we have an architecture of mind in which there are layers of goals. There's no way to avoid goals. Values, in other words. In some sense, shoulds, although I'm not using that word here. So there's a place-driving principle. I don't think we should drop babies on their head. You know, I have a good friend who just had a little baby, and I have a lot of background in early childhood development, even though I'm crippled by being male. But still, I do have some knowledge of that world, professionally and personally. And I said, you know, honestly, basically, kids tend to do really well if you just love them a ton and don't drop them on their head. You know, a lot of good, well, kind of, she was kind of nervous as a new mom. And, you know, I know there's more to parenthood than that. But it's kind of a basics, like we'd all agree, not a good idea. Don't drop them on their head, you know? Don't kick the dog. You know, don't drive drunk. There's a place for principle. Principle being to aspire, like, you know, I don't really want to, but I got to go jogging, okay. Or my mind's not really into this conversation right now, but my friend is on the phone and needs me, okay. I'm gonna call myself. I'm going to hold myself to a higher standard, if you will. I'm not saying anything about that. I think there's a real place for that. We need to be careful about it, of course, because it's easy to tip into righteousness and positionality, but I'm not speaking about that. Those, if you will, principles tend to live much more in the brain, in more like prefrontal cortex. Their values, their aspirations, their aims, visions, ideals. There's a place for that. Where the musts tend to live is much lower down, subcortex and brainstem, and also they tend to live much, in a sense, lower down in terms of learning early in childhood. Things have to be a certain way. You know, like the kid insists on something. I've been at birthday parties where everything's going great for the particular three-year-old. I mean, just birthday party heaven, right? Presents, friends, goodie bags, piñata, everything's going great. And yet, when the well-intended mom who's helping out at the birthday party cuts through the rose of the frosting of the birthday cake, so there's not a whole rose, inconsolable meltdown. All right? Inconsolable meltdown. Just cannot be consoled because much as you can't put the rose back together again. You know, it is just gone. That rose is gone. Gotta have the rose. Gotta have the rose. Right? Very, very young in us. So when we get hijacked by that very young, often adamant, black or white, rose or no rose, just doesn't matter. Everything else, the rose. I want the rose. Okay? That's when trouble really, really, really begins. So I want to explore with you a little bit in very down-to-earth ways how to grapple with some of these shoulds in our life. So let's tell the truth, right? It's easy to dump the shoulds that we don't really care about. I want to talk about the ones you really care about. And I'm thinking about the ones I really care about. And I'm going to go out here with you to all the way to life itself. So let's just kind of see what this is like here. So I'm going to ask you a question three times, okay? And we'll do this as a little experiment, talk about it a bit, and then I'll segue into some specific suggestions I have about what we can do. And these have come out of my own struggle with something that's been a should for me in my mind in the last 10 days or so. It's stirred up some stuff. So, if you would like to, think of a situation in which you have a strong should in your mind. The should typically takes the form of it should not or must not or cannot be or it can't be or, you know, a certain way, so negation, or it must be, it has to be, It's got to be a certain way. All right? So think of a situation. Could be a relationship. Often it's with other people. You know, he has to treat me with respect. They need to know how good I am. I can't get cancer. Right. So bring to mind. Kind of got one? Real. You care about. You know. It's most powerful if it's something that has a lot of charge for you. So then here's my question, and I invite you to just kind of like let it reverberate in your mind as you reflect on the rule, as it were, that's in your mind about this particular situation, this very strong view you have about it. It could be something you really long for, you really want. You know, I have to find love in this life. You know, I need to find love again. Really important. Okay, ready? Here's the question. Is that really true? Just let the question reverberate in your own way. Not getting into the right answer about it, but more like a kind of an opening around it. And then a second cycle, same situation, if it's still alive for you, as it probably is. See if you can kind of get to the heart, or at least one key rule, if you will, at the center of this situation for you, in the form of some sentence, you know, it must, or it must not, or they must, or they must not, just a must, one sentence. See if you can find a must sentence that really gets to the heart of what you want or what you care about or what the stakes are on the table here. Form it in language in your mind if you can. Get that must sentence. And then see if you can let this question just kind of reverberate for a minute or so while I'll be quiet. Okay, with regard to this must, is this really true? And then the third and last cycle. At bottom of situations that we have musts about is some experiential referent. In other words, it always comes back to some experience. It's not about the events out there. It's what I would feel in here or do feel in here. So in a certain sense, the must boils down to, I couldn't bear it if something such and such happened, or I couldn't bear it, or I can't bear it if such and such doesn't happen. You know, I couldn't stand it. I must not. In other words, it's not so much the situation must not happen, right, or the condition must not occur, or must occur a certain way. It's that deep down, the experience that relates to that for me. You know, it can't happen. It must not happen. I must not feel what I would feel if I'm mistreated. I must not, you know, I can't tolerate the pain I would feel if I got a fatal diagnosis, terminal diagnosis. You see what I'm trying to get at? There's an experience, and there's this kind of a view deep down about that experience, that it's an intolerable experience, or beyond the pale, or I couldn't handle it, or it would it's the be all and end all. Okay? So again, if you can, try to identify what that experience is, you know, what you would feel if the event that must not occur did occur, right? What you would feel if you did not get the thing that I should get here. Whatever that is, what would you feel? Could be one thing, maybe it's a couple of key things. What's at the heart of it for you? And there too, see if you can form a sentence on the order of, I must not feel worthless. I must not feel unloved. I must feel happy. I must not feel alone. I must not feel this pain. And then again, the question, letting it reverberate, is that really true? Is that really true? Okay, enough of this torture. Sometimes it just takes you into the mire. Other times there's something about that inquiry that it's like a koan. It just takes you out, stops the process. So I just wondered if you had any comments about that. And then I have six suggestions. Yeah.
I have a trouble distinguishing between I must do this and this must not happen versus I really don't want this to happen. Can you address that?
So if you heard what she said, what's the difference between I really want this or I really want to do this compared to I must do this or, you know, this must happen or I really want this to happen? Did I get that? Okay. Or I really don't want that to happen? Well, that'll take me to my first suggestion, which is in what you're bringing up there. There's a difference between the experience of longing or vitality for something or clear aversion. You know, like we put some food in our mouth that's bad, like it's bad food or something. We want to get it out quickly. There's something very natural about that. We're in actually the experience of it. The must, if you're tracking this, it's an abstraction. It's an idea, often represented in language, that sits on top of reality itself. So one of the very first things we can do to break out of the chains, really, of the shoulds, these rules on us, is to step out of the concept, the idea, and step and explore and enter into the experience itself. That distinction right there is really central. If you think of it, the must is sort of this top-down instruction from the big boss inside, right? Whereas feeling the experience of it is something extremely different entirely. And it's like getting out of the concept or the idea into the thing itself. What's the actual sensation or what's the situation itself? I'm in a situation, let's say, I want someone to love me. I want someone to treat me well. I've treated them really well. I've done it right. They're not treating me well. Has that ever happened to anyone in the room? Probably. Definitely has happened to me, you know. And yet they're not. Okay, what do we do? Well, I could live in my story about it, my narrative. We all have a narrative, like this happened and why did it happen and how bad it was that it happened, and I gave them this and they didn't give me that. We have a lot of narrative about it. And in that narrative are various values and rules in our kind of case. That's, we know what it's like to be in the narrative of it compared to just engaging the situation directly, kind of with don't know mind. Don't know. It is what it is. The situation is what it is. The sight of it is what it is. The sound of it is what it is. The emotions in me about it are what they are. If I'm just kind of coming down into that territory, that's the first way, or one of six, or probably more than six, to not be so trapped by shoulds. I think, too, there's a general gut feeling in us that's the ultimate referent that usually we're pretty clear about. You know, what is flourishing compared to what is suffering and harm? You know, does it facilitate flourishing for ourselves and others, happiness and welfare, or does it lead to contraction, suffering, and harm? That's a pretty good marker for whether to lean left or lean right or whatever, forward, backward, up or down. Great. Maybe one more person and then I'll keep going. Yeah. Yes.
And so then I noticed, like, well, maybe my life then of wearing those glasses,
yeah,
in situations where, you know, I think then it becomes your fear or whatever, you're trying to control or get out of, you know, aversion,
yeah,
away from the reality instead of, as you're just saying, sitting in,
yeah,
comfortably with the way things are,
yeah,
and be present to it without referring to your habitual pattern of
Yes, thank you for saying, yeah, very eloquent. My probably less eloquent pivot off of that is to say, yes, that's one of the other six methods I have, half dozen, which is to go to that. It's very interesting. When you do this, when you drop the must, very often, as you have described there, and I have experienced too, it takes you into this real vulnerability because you have to face the fact that at the other, how can I put it, so many of these musts are like these futile attempts to construct bulwarks against the inevitabilities of life, of death, of physical pain, dementia, decay. As I said last week, entering in triumph and withdrawing in decrepitude. But anyway, you know, And one of the ways then to, again, get out of the cage of shoulds is to be willing to bear the horribleness of what can happen. It's not to prefer it, it's to do what we can about it, but to have a certain level of a kind of softening and the dignity. You think of people, my personal observation, who are through the shock, and then they're just simply in the experience, who have the dignity and grace to be in and with terrible things. There's something in their face. You can see it in their face. You can feel it. I'm getting the shivers in my body just talking about it. That's available to all of us, but it comes from a kind of utter bareness, you know, where we drop the arrogance that somehow we can hold that ultimately at bay. We can't. Each one of us is going to be taken by that great tide. Everyone we love. Our kids, that's the weird one. Dear ones, innocents. Terrible things are going to happen to innocent people before we go to bed tonight. I'll tell you something I do sometimes. Hopefully it's not too weird for you. You might do it too sometimes. It's to be in a room like this, and without being weird about it, just kind of wonder, who's going to die first? It is a little morbid. But it's very poignant because I might be the first to go. You know, you look around, you figure the older people are, the more their odds go up. But you realize in this room, one person among us is going to die first. which is a very intimate way to kind of get the reality that, wow, and to have compassion for anyone who could face that fate, and to know that that fate will face us too one day. So, you know, if it does, in other words, the more it makes you squirm, probably the better it is for us. Okay, good. Yeah.
Steve Martin, the comedian, once came out on stage and everybody was smiling, laughing, and he said, "You're a pretty happy crowd considering you're all going to die one day."
Yeah.
And people were like, they didn't know how to take it.
Yeah, that's right. It's like it's the shocker. And other things, people, you know, many people disappoint. Rick Hansen, Buddhist teacher, said that many people disappoint. But isn't it true? You know? Many people disappoint when the chips are down. They won't do the hard thing. They won't come through when it's difficult. They won't stand on principle when it's hard. They won't acknowledge fault. They'll punish you for bringing their faults to their attention. I mean, many people will disappoint. I'm not countenancing it. I'm just saying there can be, as you've said, a kind of softening that drops the muss about that and faces the reality of it all. Nothing in this is that we should not aspire to rise as best we can, but it's a way, these are different ways to help us relax the shoulds. Yeah.
So what's coming to me is that in an absolute sense there are no musts or shoulds in an absolute sense.
Can you say what you mean?
Well, I just, if you look at each individual situation, I went through your exercise. You know, I must be a better father. To my adult son, I must have better, more respect from him, or a better none of that really is true.
Yeah.
In an absolute
That's right.
sense. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't want to put my best foot forward and be the best person I can be. But to say a should or a must, it doesn't make sense anymore in light of what you've taken us through, to me.
Oh, no. Right on. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, Lee.
So is it almost like pissing in the wind to make a request?
No. I'm so not saying that, you know. Number one, sure, it's fine to make requests. Number two, it's fine to, in a sense, I think, insist as a condition of a relationship. You know, if you yell at me like that again, you know, I'm not going to keep dating you. Duh. You don't do your homework, no dessert, or something. You know, there's plenty of. Or I'd really like it if you would work harder inside your mind when I'm talking to try to really sustain attention to me and imagine how I'm feeling over here. And I promise I'll do the same for you. Would you be willing to do that from now on? Okay, why not? That's very fundamental. That's kind of bedrock for long-term relationship health, really, unless you get incredibly lucky. So yeah, there's a place for that, I think. Okay, one more person, then. Yeah, go on. Blythe. If I follow you right, the way I would speak to it is that shoulds and musts for me are one way to go into the story, and they're often woven through the story of a situation where we're feeling mistreated or frustrated. Okay?
So what's the should then?
I'll tell you a little story. So the thing I've been grappling with, and I'll because I'm fairly public, I'll disguise this slightly. But so I'm in a situation where I've been dealing with an organization, and I thought they would. So very often shoulds are linked to expectations and disappointment and our reaction to disappointment. So I thought they would be interested in doing a different thing with me in a year. And to my surprise, they weren't. They just wanted to keep doing the same thing, okay? Because for them, it's a proven formula, and if it ain't broke, don't fix it, okay? For me, I expected that they'd be willing to do a different thing for a variety of reasons. You know, it was reasonable that I had that expectation. It wasn't psychotic. But in their frame, it made no sense to them to do that thing. It's not a big deal. It's a small thing. And so I could watch myself getting disappointed. My expectations were violated. Technically, in the brain, you know, what dopamine in particular tracks is expectations. Expectations are fulfilled, dopamine stays steady. Expectations are not fulfilled, dopamine drops, which then sends this ripple through the body-mind that feels uncomfortable and unpleasant. You're in the territory now of negative emotions, of frustration and disappointment, which then, following my mind stream, which may be like yours a little bit, went into taking it personally and forming a righteous case about why they were wrong, right? Which then I had the good sense, partly supported by my wife, to not express out into the world, only internally, which I suffered from for a week and a half, okay? And have sort of written it out. And the breakthrough for me, honestly, was to really look into the heart, as Tom said, of the narrative, to get at, well, is that actually true? Must they do that? Or to take it all the way down, must I get the kind of goodie I'm wanting here? Is there a rule somewhere in the universe? I think the area of a circle on a flat plane must be pi r squared. Okay, I'll go that far. You know what I mean? There's some things that just sort of, they're going to be what they are. You know, big, massy bodies attract each other. That's how it is. But, you know, that this particular organization must treat me this way and give me this thing that I deserve. Where is that written? I'm sorry, I missed that fourth rule of thermodynamics. There were only, or law. You know what I mean? There wasn't one. I missed, see what I'm trying to get at? And so if you just follow a situation, especially where there's a should or a must, often there's a violation of expectation, there's a disappointment, then there's often a taking it personally, which becomes a case with a certain amount of righteousness. And then, you know, unless you have really good filters and a good mate, bleep, stuff starts coming out that then creates a lot of problems. And then 3 days later, 3 months later, 3 hours later, you feel like a fool. Okay? See, that's what I'm talking about. And so if I could, just in the interest of time, and by the way, it's a little warm suddenly for me. Would you be willing to open that door, Blythe, if that's okay? So I want to just pivot off of this, if I could, again, in the interest of time, and offer a few more suggestions. All right? So my third suggestion, we have one, dropping down into the experience, getting out of the conceptualization, the languaging, the inner languaging of it, the narrative around it, trying to be with the object itself, the thing itself, the situation itself, and the experience in the body itself. Okay. Two, as you said, really see if you can be brave enough and wise enough to soften and open to all the dreadful possibilities, and to not try to use these shoulds as some kind of shield against the realities and possibilities of life and what could actually happen in the next minute, which we don't know, right? Here, be really careful, this is my third suggestion in my own story, of taking things personally. It's so easy to move into shoulds off of taking it personally. Or there's some kind of Or the should is about the ego, the I, you know, the me. This presumed essentialized entity looking out through the eyes that cannot be found in any scan of the brain whatsoever. There's no localization of self anywhere in the brain. Okay. So that's the third thing to think about, to break free of these chains. Okay. And then the fourth suggestion was in what Tom said there, which is to realize that actually there is no necessitation of the should. It's not embedded in reality. Reality is just what it is. It turned out to be what it is. In a weird kind of way, thinking about this organization and me, you know, what actually must be the case is what is the case. Because that's what was determined by all the 10,000 causes upstream. So if you're looking for a must or a should, it's what has happened that you didn't like, that I didn't like. See what I mean? It's funny when you do that little thing. Is that really true? Must it actually be true that innocent children don't die? I'm not, again, countenancing that. Obviously, it's tragic. It's immoral if it could be prevented reasonably and all the rest of that. But must it be the case? You see, when you, it's kind of like you want to help yourself have a koan moment where the mind just kind of goes, gloop. If you're having a little, you're on the right track. All right. Then the other thing is thinking again about this organization or your own situations, realizing that very often our must or should is, it pretends to have it have this sort of absolutist, universalist, top-down, angelic Mount Olympus view of the universal laws, right? But actually, our musts or shoulds are usually very partial. They're very parochial. They're based on our little wedge of the pie. And if we stepped over here and looked at us and our situation from truly a bigger perspective, or we looked at us through the eyes of the other person or organization or situation, given their needs and whatnot, you know, what we think must be the case to them is not self-evident at all. There's a line or two from Longfellow, which I don't have with me, I'm going to paraphrase it. He says basically, if we could for only one moment look at the world through the eyes of our enemy, you know, what grievances could we possibly hold after that? You know? So there's a way in which often if we like lay on the shoulds, this is very powerful with family members. We have shoulds about family members often. They should respect me more. They should not drop their kid off to be babysat by me, my niece, who's quite sick, actually, with a significant cold, while they go off and lollygag around out of cell phone range. They should not do that. Okay, sure. From a principled standpoint, that was a mistake. That was a problem. But if you look at it through the other person's eyes, you just really don't know the totality of what led them to do that particular thing on that particular day. I don't mean moral relativism. I don't mean letting them off the hook. But I mean softening the adamancy, the commandmentness that we can get so often caught up in. Yeah?
I heard somebody explain it something like this today, where she just used as a really simple little check-in point to see where she was with a situation was saying, was this pleasant, unpleasant, or am I neutral? Well, she's in a situation where all of a sudden the interaction was unpleasant.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, I'm holding on to something. I'm grasping at the way something has to be. I just need to soften around it.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's fantastic. And so that was a person who was tracking her own territory and also recognizing, I think, a lot that a lot of the oughts and the musts are around the unpleasant. You know, the unpleasant aversion or the fear of unpleasant, you know, the expectation of unpleasant is very powerful to drive our sort of insistences. So then to go to the sixth and last of my little suggestions here for breaking free of the shoulds, it's to open to what you might have intuited in that little inquiry process with those three questions repeated, which is to a kind of freedom. You know, when you step out of the must, it's weird. You feel really free. The situation is still what it is. It may be unpleasant in it, but suddenly there's a kind of freedom because, in effect, the command, if you will, that's embedded in the should or the must is most targeted to us. We're the one who gets most under the thumb of the must, the rule, the should, right? We apply a lot of shoulds to ourselves, and even if we apply them to certain situations, it really captures the mind. You know, my mind, I could just feel it continuing to go back, like having a cold sore in your mouth. You know, your tongue just keeps migrating back to it somehow, the particular situation. But when you relax that ruleness, the mustness, this delusion, if you will, that there actually are musts in the universe, it takes you to a kind of freedom that you can have a taste of and build out from. Like, what if you imagine now, here's the last round, same situation. Whether you could take it as the situation you were thinking about or kind of the deep down rule in your previous position about it or the experience that you wanted to avert. Just take a moment here to reflect and see if you can soften and open into what would it be like to let this go? What would it be like to let this should go? To let this must or ought or rule or insistence go? I might still have my wishes, I might still have my experience, but fundamentally, to let the adamancy of it go. Gotta have the whole rose, you know, letting that go. So I'll be quiet just as you feel into that. See if you can help yourself get a taste of that. One way to relate to Buddha Dharma is quite abstractly or conceptually. It's very beautiful in many ways. And still, where practice really is right here, what we've talked through tonight and explored. This is not the only place practice is, but practice needs to be here if it's to be anywhere at all, right here. In this intimacy with our own experience and the very natural tendency to go to should or must or ought, that's not a sin, that's so human. It's so the animal we are. We are the animal that creates rules. Maybe that's what really distinguishes us among all the other animals on the planet. But that said, that rule-making process really traps us. And it drives a very powerful fire of craving that leads to suffering and harm. And on the other side of it, in the immediacy of practice, right here, right now, in daily life, dropping our thing, stepping out of the must with someone we live with or sleep with or grew up with or go to or work with or have a business arrangement with or see on a political ad or hear about across the world. You know, if we can step out of that, there really is a profound liberation, which is the fundamental teaching of the Buddha, available to us. So I thought I could end on a quote from him. He says, "Little though one recites the sacred texts, but puts the teaching into practice, forsaking lust, hatred, and delusion, with true wisdom and emancipated mind, clinging to nothing of this or any other world, one indeed partakes of the blessings of a holy life. You don't have to read the sacred texts. You don't have to preach them. You don't have to wear robes. You don't have to put on any kind of certain airs. But walk the talk. Clinging to nothing, including shoulds, as well as other views. Nothing of this or any other world. Let's sit with this for a minute. Thanks for your practice. I'll see you in 5 weeks because Linda, our wonderful guest teacher, will be doing 4 weeks in a row starting next week. And I've sent out an email about it. And I really encourage you to come and be very generous with your Donna. Anyway, take care.